teacher.
Over the past few weeks, I've been talking about the unperfect practice of the perfections. Well, I got started, most of you who were here last few weeks, remember I got started with one of the perfections is the practice of patience, the perfection of patience, and I found that that was being patient with impatience. So I started from there, finding the imperfect practice of the perfections, because they're not about being perfect, they're about being human. So the sixth, the final, the pivot, really, of the perfections is wisdom, the perfection of wisdom, called prajna, or prajna paramita. Prajna is the Sanskrit for wisdom, and prajna paramita is the perfection of wisdom, or wisdom that goes beyond wisdom. The wisdom of reality. And it's really a pivot for the whole thing. And one reason that words like get carried forward, like prajna, is because there are lots of different kinds of wisdom. And the word prajna says wisdom coming as from an understanding of a Buddhist perspective. But nonetheless, we'll use wisdom as our word. But when I say that here, I do mean it in coming out of the Buddha Dharma. But also, it's wisdom of reality. So it's not just a specifically Buddhist viewpoint. Because the whole Buddhist viewpoint is, this is a natural universe of cause and effect. And the Buddhism is, how are you going to live your life as a human being on this as a foundation? World of cause and effect is coming and going and seething and moving, endlessly changing. And how are you going to live as a human being in a natural universe of cause and effect means a natural universe where everything comes to be in dependence on a lot of other conditions. And in happening becomes the conditions and causes of other things happening. So everything is woven together and moving together and never stopping. How are you going to live as a person in a universe like that? That's the whole purpose of Buddhism, is to say, how are you going to live as a human in a world like that? So wisdom in Buddhism is how do you see it, and what do you do about it? And all week it was brought home to me over and over, both from everything I read and from the Sangha and from my own life. There's a great deal of anxiety at Loose in the Land. There always is, but there's more now. I mean, it's urgent in so many lives right now. Here in the Sangha, in this country and around the world, there's, you know, the economic crisis presses hard on people, and everyone already does feel pressed. So then the sense of pressure or problem or burden can really becomes alarming to people. Loss of jobs, experience a lot in loss, right? Loss of jobs, loss of retirement, loss of home, loss of investment. Loss of a sense of how to go forward. Great anxiety underlying that about future and the future, and about personal security. So the newspaper was full of articles about people having suddenly having sort of panic attacks, for instance, because you don't know what's going to happen next. You know, you're so much more aware suddenly of the rug being pulled out from under. You don't know if it's about to happen to you in what form, but we're much more aware of it. And then, on the other hand, it seemed as though last week there was a mass shooting a day where people are just pushed beyond whatever they're. These are people who, for one reason or another, feel already pushed to their limits. And, of course, the Dharma would say, yes, and look at you look at all the conditions, and one of the conditions in that situation is the ready availability of guns. You know, they're practical conditions as well as, conditions that sort of make for anxiety in our lives. All the conditions are entirely relevant to our lives. Anyway, I was thinking about talking about prajna, the great wisdom at the heart of the Buddhist teaching, and that's the really the central pivot of the perfections. And here's this real world where we're all having panic attacks. Right? Well, people where there's a lot of anxiety. And if I talked about prajna in some kind of lofty terms, it might be a soothing distraction. I could take you away with me for a little while. But it won't meet your life. Right? A soothing distraction actually is very helpful, but for a little while. It's kind of like going to the movies. And I don't really want the Buddha Dharma to be like going to the movies. Right? I go to the movies too. I really like animated movies particularly. You know you're going for a great distraction. Some of them, the Japanese director Miyazaki's movies, have tremendous environmental messages or things too. But I'm going to be transported into another world. And it's good. It's fine. And then the movie ends and you come out again. You know? And maybe you feel a little better. Soothing is good. But it doesn't actually... It knit your life in a very small way. There's nothing wrong with that, but it doesn't really meet your whole life. It doesn't speak to your whole life. So the Buddha Dharma is vast and inspiring, and it can have a truly soothing effect on our lives. That's one thing about reading Dharma books sometimes, is that they have that, oh, there's a large or something out there, and there's just a soothing quality to even remembering that. But the truly soothing effect of the Buddha Dharma is not from short-lived ecstasies. Although reading a book that reminds you that there's something bigger is not a short-lived ecstasy. It says, oh, look, remember that your life is more than you can see right now. But that, if it's just a moment's thought, like all thoughts, then it's gone. So the vast and inspiring Buddha Dharma is the vastness of a wisdom about living your actual life as well as possible. So we have to keep bringing it down to earth where we really live. And that's part of my theme of the unperfect practice of the perception of the perfections, is that they are designed for us as we are. We have a true perfectness, but it's not our idea of what it's like to be perfect. Because we're never going to meet our idea of what it's like to be perfect. Ideas never really do come true. Those are ideas. So how can this great wisdom be a real teaching for our real lives full of anxiety and insecurity? So number one, there's always another problem. That's the first wisdom for the unwise in the Buddha Dharma. We have a problem, and we want to solve it, and we want to settle, and we think that once we solve it, we'll sort of settle. There's always another problem. This is one of the truths of the Buddha Dharma. This is a truth of a world of cause and effect, of conditions, of endlessly changing, endlessly arising. So you have a problem, and either way you decide, sometimes there's lots of choices, but most often you can go this way or you can go that way. And they both have advantages, and they both have pitfalls, and it's apples and oranges, and how are you going to choose? And you just drive yourself nuts over choosing. And either way you decide, there's going to be another problem. Now, it's not to say that the problem or the thinking about which way to go doesn't matter. In the Buddha Dharma, everything matters. Right? Because this is a world of causes and conditions. You better pay attention to the conditions and the causes, because they will have a big effect. If someone has a gun or doesn't have a gun, will have an effect on how they play out their insecurities. The facts and the details matter tremendously. They do matter. They matter tremendously. But it's very important to remember that no matter which way you decide, there's going to be another problem, because that changes how we deal with our problem. See, the problems are, in general, most of our problems anyway, are sort of factual. Am I going to do this or am I going to do that? And there's good, serious conditions and facts and information to be found out about this and about that. and you choose as carefully as you can. One choice may be better than the other for your life, and you can't even know for sure. There are always more causes and conditions than you can possibly know. So you investigate. You maybe you're thorough, maybe you're just intuitive. Whatever your style is, even if you are the most thorough investigator, sort of. Right. Guilty. No matter how many conditions you investigate and you know, there are conditions you cannot be aware of, because there are always more. And so you cannot know all the facts or all the influences on the situation. So you're always going in with limited information. So you make the best choice you can. But neither choice will end your problems. And if you remember that, it has a big effect on that whole process of figuring out what to do at this moment. Because if you really believe that yes, the details matter, yes, the decision matters, yes, the intuition matters, what if all the factors I'm going to take into account, it all matters, and which way I choose does matter, and I can't know for sure what the outcome is, so for sure, which is the right, whatever that might be, choice. But if I also know, in addition, that neither choice will end problems, stop them from happening, then I can take care of it just on its own terms. Oh, this is a particular problem to be taken care of in a particular way, and I have to settle in the middle of a world that has problems, and another problem, and another problem. See, if I take this issue thinking I'm going to solve it and I'm going to settle down, and I won't, and my life is going to go smoothly, I'm putting too much on it. It's not gonna be able to do that. And so then I'm pushing. I can't see it clearly because I'm operating from my ideas about it. And the Buddha Dharma says, drop your ideas about it and pay attention to things as they really are. So this problem and the right choice, whatever that might be, and I can't even know for sure, it's not gonna solve my life. There will always be willy-waws. It's a wonderful word. I found it in the dictionary many years ago. It's an American Indian word from maybe New England Indians, or maybe it's Algonquin, for changeable winds. The sailors use it. If you're sailing a little sailboat and the wind shifts around, you've got to suddenly tack and come about, or you might get swamped. Willy-waws are winds that keep shifting. It's a wonderful word because our lives are full of willy-waws. W-I-L-L-I-W-A-W. Willy-waw. Is the Anglicization of this Algonquin or other Native American word. If I really believe that there will always be willy-waws and problems, then I won't be so tossed away by the winds, by the fact that there's another one. The actual problem could be very big and could toss me away, knock me over, but I won't be so surprised by the fact of it happening. It'll be what it is, this problem, not also, oh my God, there's another problem. And then I can't even see it because I'm so knocked over by the fact of it happening. So the Buddha Dharma says, yes, there are going to be problems, but you don't also have to be knocked over in surprise at there being another problem. Just believe it. Accept the reality of life as endlessly changing. And there's many wonderful aspects of endlessly changing life. One is creativity. One is potential. The fact that new things come up is because life is endlessly changing. And the fact that problems come up is because new things come up that don't suit me or don't work for me. And I call it a problem. And whether I like it or don't like it, it happens that way. There will always be willy-waws. So when we really accept, by testing it out for all these years, that there's always another problem, that they keep coming up, that they come up not because there's something wrong with you. That's our other default. Oh, there's something wrong with me, I've always got problems, right? No, it's the nature of things. It's the nature of being an individual in whom all kinds of circumstances and conditions happen, and they don't happen for me. for my benefit. It's not this kind of teleological world that's organized around for me or against me. Things come up, and they will or will not be conducive to either my life or my life as I expect it. Or there'll be something I call a problem, I mean an obstacle. If I accept that life, that there will always be another problem, there will always be willy-wars, changeable winds, then I can take better care of the problem at hand, because it's just what it is. It's the problem at hand. It's not an obstacle to the solution of my life. It's just the problem it is. And there is no solution that will stop the arising of problems. So you don't have to look for the solution that will stop the arising of problems and feel like a dummy because you can't find it. That's the problem isn't that that we're dummies. The problem is that we're thinking of the wrong idea about this. It's just it's a problem that has to be taken care of for what it really is, not for a life solution. So since that's not what to look for, I shouldn't be looking for which is the solution that will solve my life. Instead, I can say, which choice will put me in a better position to meet the next problem? This is kind of a novel idea, isn't it? If I accept that there's likely to be something else that I will perceive as an obstacle, or that I'm likely to get tossed away by or have difficulty with, what if I make one of my ways I think about making my choice, which of these roads, which of these paths or choices will seem to me, from where I stand now, to put me in a better place for dealing with another problem that might arise? So maybe I shouldn't spend all my money assuring myself that this will solve my problems, because I won't have, I will be closing a door on my possibilities of meeting future problems, which are pretty well guaranteed. So the question of what choice will put you in a better position to meet the next difficulty is actually very much more encouraging. If you accept the reality of problems, then they're just problems. Then they're obstacles that we can look at and meet. And then not only do we have maybe a little bit better handle on these dealing with the facts and issues of problem solving, because they are just those problems, then you can also look more deeply for what might be a solution to problematic life. The Buddha Dharma is not just a practical goal plan. And in fact, the way it's practical is to say, hey, don't believe your ideas that you're going to solve all your problems by figuring out the right solution here. Let it just be a problem. Know that there's more problems. Okay, that's somewhat practical advice, maybe. But it also frees you up to ask a larger question. What might be a way to deal with the whole of problematic life, or of my life as a problem? And the first step in that is to say, solutions to problematic life do not mean no more problems. We're always looking for the perfect teaching that will help us solve problematic life so that all will feel calm and soothing and tranquil. You can look for the rest of your life. A solution for a human life doesn't mean no more problems, because life has problems. So does that mean there's no kind of solution for feeling at the mercy of problems? No, it doesn't mean that. It means that we're barking up the wrong tree. What kind of solution can there be to problematic life? How do we live in the middle of problematic life without just being inundated by one problem after another after another? And this is where the prajna, wisdom, comes in. It says we can take a large look. And the prajna paramita, perfection of wisdom, in classical Buddhism is a woman, is a goddess. She's called the mother of all Buddhas. Thank you very much. In Indian iconography, she's a beautiful goddess, the mother of all Buddhas. Uh, also in the sense of that creative base from which solutions arise, from which truths and solutions arise. And this sense is given in the iconography, that feminine cast, the feminine generative principle. But we all have a generative principle, even the men, including the men. So what kind of wisdom is this profound understanding of reality called prajna or wisdom? It's not a fact, and it's not a received truth. Believe this and you'll be happy. It's an insight and it's a process. The insight, wisdom, when it's, Prajaparamita is the goddess, mother of all Buddhas, and then also takes form in the imagery as Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, who carries a sword. So we get the sort of that yang energy here. The sword for cutting through delusions. Only thing that this wisdom, it's an insight to cut through your delusions so that light can shine through, so that you can see more clearly. So it's a kind of wisdom that cuts through delusions. It cuts through, particularly, through our illusions of solidity, because we don't enjoy a lot of the time, we don't enjoy the sense of movement and things coming to be and passing away. We don't like all this impermanence. And we need a sense to have a sense of security. Our mind and our body says, well, you know, but I'm here, I'm just like this, I'm solid and these are solid and permanent. And of course we discover they're not. We get sick, someone dies, there's an accident, we lose our job. Nothing is very solid and very permanent. And Buddha Dharma says that we cannot stop life changing, but we can stop the suffering of clinging to an idea that it shouldn't change, that we'd be happier and better off believing in a world that doesn't change. But that world isn't how it really is. So in fact, it is not a happier, safer world where we believe everything is solid and hunky-dory. The wisdom cuts through our illusions of I'm here and solid and you're there and solid and we're just completely distinct. Well, yes, we are individuals arising out of each other's causes and conditions. Our lives are linked. Our lives impact and influence each other and influence the floor and the sky and the walls and people around the world and all kinds of creatures. We cut through our notions of separateness and opposition to see what kind of separation there really is and what kind there isn't. And cut through our notions of what it is to be me so that I can see what I really am. Wisdom doesn't say this old no self stuff is so confusing. It doesn't say that there isn't, you're not here, you don't exist. It says you're not what you think you are. We keep making ideas of our own what we are and what we need, and what I need to be comfortable, and how my life should go. We all do this over and over and over. And those ideas are not really who we really are. So this is a wisdom that's called the wisdom of emptiness. Right? Empty of permanence, empty of being solid, empty of immortality, empty of guarantees of ease and repose according to our ideas of them. Empty of a promise of prosperity or long life. None of that is promised to us. And yet, this emptiness, this very same emptiness, is the basis for all our interconnected life. If things weren't empty of the kind of separation that we think they have, we couldn't put a carrot in our mouth, chew it, eat it, and digest it, and have it produce food value that makes our life go forward. It's because we are so interconnected, interpenetrated, so involved, so made of the same stuff that our lives can keep going. So this interconnected life really supports us all completely and gives us great joy. You know, I think we all kind of know it, but then psychologists do studies about how, with kids, say, where a scolding remark is five times more memorable than praise. You have to have five compliments to equal one critical remark in terms of how we remember things. Now, let's say criticism is so much louder in our ears, right? And it's apparently at a 5-to-1 ratio generally for most people, which is kind of sad. So in our lives, we tend to be so much more aware of the problem side. And I don't think it's just, you know, how silly of us. Our organism is geared to notice problems so we can take care of them, so that we are very sensitive to things that to alarms of every sort, because we're supposed to take care of this one. And problems are more a threat to this one's integrity than a compliment, so we tend to notice them more. I think it's sort of a hardwired thing. But we could try to take account of that and say, oh yeah, I feel the problem of uneasy impermanence as a problem in my life. Oh, but maybe I'm forgetting how it supports my life at every moment. Every breath we take is impermanence happening. We can't take another breath without it being an impermanent world. So really, we're completely supported at any one moment by a life of impermanence. So, wisdom is an insight and a process and maybe an attitude arising out of that. We have to keep opening our eyes and finding over and over the eye of insight that sees that this is a world of change and impermanence and creation, and a world of interconnection, and a world in which, from the point of view of this one, wanting its life to go on comfortably, there will always be something that will come up as a problem. And that's just how it is, that there will be problems. Because I'm soft-bodied and I'm not immortal and I get hungry. Right? So we need to keep, and we have a mind that keeps turning away from that. It keeps saying, oh, no, this is how it is. This is what Richard looks like. I know Richard. Richard would be very surprised to think that I know Richard. He's a lot more subtle. There's a lot more going on there than I could possibly know. So what does it mean to say I know Richard? It would mean I've got an idea of who Richard is. And it's operational. It's pretty good. I can pick out Richard apart from Holly. You know, this is pretty good. You're right. You're saved by the bell. But as long as I remember that it's kind of a provisional idea, then I can be pleasantly surprised when he doesn't act like my idea. But if it's a really strongly held idea and he acts outside of the range of that, I'm going to be pissed, you know? It's going to be a problem because I have an idea of how Richard's supposed to be and he's not meeting my expectations, right? So that's suddenly there's a problem. But if I say, oh, my idea of who Richard is partial and impermanent and incomplete but provisionally okay for now, then when he does something, it widens my idea of who Richard is and my connection with him, and my life is bigger and my sense of who he is bigger, and I haven't had a problem. I've just had a little bit more Richard. Right? It's not a problem. It's a little more Richard. So there's the attitude of insight is an attitude that holds things somewhat loosely. It says, oh, here I am. Oh, what's today? Oh, this is my life? Oh, hello. Over and over and over. It's an attitude of knowing that expectations are rigid ideas and that they don't advance our cause. In fact, the cutting through delusion of Manjushri is to see that I'm living at expectations. We don't like to see it that way. We think this is just my idea of life. It's a pretty good idea of life. We don't like to see that it's a mass of expectations and agendas. But if we see that, then we don't have to be caught by them. Then we can hold it loosely, and then they're not expectations and agendas anymore. They're just ideas. I was reading in preparation for the study group that's starting Wednesday on how to cook your life, which is very much in the same theme. I was rereading the book we'll use, How to Cook Your Life. And I came to a place in Uchiyama Roshi's essays where he says, the spirit of the Buddha's teachings refuses to offer a god in exchange for freedom from anxiety. Instead, freedom from anxiety can only be found at that point where the self settles naturally upon itself. Just his way of trying to describe the process that comes out of the insight. There's this insight over and over and over that I'm creating a rigid view where really life is moving and creative and changing. And the process that I go through with that insight is, how do I live with this? How do I relate to someone from a me to a you when we're both moving and changing, but we're also sort of more or less the same for now, but I don't even know exactly who you are, little, or who I am, and yet we want to relate. What is the process of being human in a world that's that kind of complicated, in which paper folds, not the direction you want it to? So Uchiyama Roshi's way of describing that is, the self settles naturally upon itself. So then you say, well, what's the self? And that's, again, we go back to what's the process or the insight. Say, well, what kind of self is he talking about? He's saying, your life settles where your true or whole self lives. Not the self I think I have. That's a narrow little. See, if I'm the self I think I have is like this little boat in the sea, and it's going to be knocked over. I'm going to get very seasick very quickly. And if I identify myself as just this one little bit of self that has this one little agenda, and everything else is a problem, I'm going to be very seasick and very full of obstacles. He's saying, what is your self really? What is the true self? Well, if I'm connected to all other beings, my life is made out of the lives of all these other beings in a general way and in a specific way and at all times in ways I don't understand, then somehow myself is connected to and not separate from and is in some way made of these others. And my life right now is a process of what's happening here and now. And that process is always meeting. How well do I meet Jude when I see her? How well do I meet this moment? How well do I meet the fact that I'm buying a house and I don't know if I'm going to get it? Right? How do I meet this moment? How I meet this moment is the kind of self I've got right now. And if I see myself as just this wee, sleeked beastie being tossed around by the willy-waws, it's very seasick. If I see this self as a self that is a personal individual connected to and part of a vast universe, it's very different. So in fact, I am trying to buy a house. And it's a hairy, a hair-raising, scary and difficult thing. I have barely enough money to buy a house. And it's a house in foreclosure. And so there's always more problems. Are you going to qualify for your mortgage? Well, the upside of that is that mortgage rates are very low, so people like me can afford them. Yeah, we can get them. So there's this teeter-totter. And then the house is relatively inexpensive because it's in foreclosure, which means you don't know enough about it to know if you can risk your money buying it. You know? Yeah, you're with me here. Huge amounts of time and energy and investigation and inspections. And there's a paid inspections and three or four of those. And then there's the unpaid ones, the contractors who come out of, they hope you will hire them. But meanwhile, out of their skill in their lives, they say, here's this and here's that, and let me explain this to you and let me explain that to you. These are lovely people coming. I've met a lot of really fine people. And then there's the well driller, because I need a new well, because it's a shared well. And well, but if you don't even know you can dig a well there, how can you buy a house if you don't know you have any water for the long term? But you can't dig a well before you own the house. So what are you going to do? Well, there's a wonderful well driller who lives right down the road and has a wonderful reputation. He's just really kind, and he's come over, and we've looked at the place. And I'm friends with the people at the Permit and Resource now, too. We're getting along well. Really nice people. You know, they get kind of a bad rap in well and septic because they have power to say, no, you can't. And they do have that power. But actually, they're also really nice people. So I've had really nice connections with people at the PRMD as well. And so it's, and now it's hanging on the written loan commitment. And you know, every couple of days there's been another last problem. And then, guess what, there'd be another one. So I've had a lot of study of this issue of the problem after problem, and where they just, there's always another one. And then, if the loan commitment comes through, and I buy this house, it's just beginning! I'm buying an old house with problems! It's just not going to stop. And then if I get the old immediate problem settled, well, I have a house with a property, and they, oh, you know, the grass is going to keep growing, the weeds, and the, you know, there's, it's never going to stop. There's problems never going to stop. This is, and if I don't buy a house, then I don't have a stable place to live. That's a problem too. You know, there's just no way around this. And a lot of them are out of my control. That's another feature. These problems, the ones that are really out of, you do everything you can. You show up like a good scout. You know, the lenders are really nervous these days, because the guy in that office there in New Jersey who approves a loan that doesn't go well, you know, how could you? Well, you know, so they want proof of what they already have proof of. And it's just their anxiety. But all I can do is send another piece of paper, another piece of paper, another piece of paper. Mm-hmm. And for a while, through this process, I had my dear friends Ty, and then after she left, Elska was here. And I could go through this, hours and hours of this stuff, and then I would turn and I would see a face. I could come here, do the same thing, come here, and see a face of someone I know who's not a problem. Not today. Not a problem I know is a problem. Right now, you're an opportunity to remember that we're just human together. Right? Just people. Oh, my goodness. You know. And then I could transfer that actually back to, that's why the well and septic people and the well driller, well, these are, I really like all these people a lot. Let alone my realtor. You know, thank goodness we like each other. We're spending a lot of time together. So these people, I have to remember. So finally now, if I don't get the house, I know so many more really fine people. And I suppose there'll be another house. There'll be another try. All the way through it again. But it reminded me that there's always another problem. And they are real, and I do have to take care of them. But none of them ends problems. And they're just factual problems. Big ones. I would like to own a house. I've already spent a lot of money trying to find out if I'm going to buy this house, right? And they're just problems. And then there's Helen or Jude or Zazen. Zazen is very good for that. Or a walk in the woods. Or a bell rings. Or for me, at the end of morning Zazen, I get up and I chant those three refuges. Oh, all I have to do is stand there and they sort of happen. It's a really wonderful thing. So those are the ways, the seeing the face of someone who reminds me that we're just here with our hearts. Those are what I mean by settling, the life settling on itself, or the self settling as the self. I don't want to settle down as just this person who's worried about a mortgage. Yuck. That's no way to live a life. That's not a me. That's not who I am. That's something that's happening in my life. Who I am is heart and mind and the sun and my friends, my sangha, and the Buddha Dharma and Zazen and the Triple Refuge. That's the self. And so if I can settle in all of that, then problems are just a normal part of the landscape, and I can include that as part of my life. That's what the Zen practice of finding equanimity in the middle of a problematic life. And sometimes we have to say, you know, right now I'm tossed away. Right now the problems are so big in my face that I can't help be tossed away. And then our practice is to be gentle. Just as in Zazen, that's why Zazen is such good training. You're doing Zazen and you realize you're out to lunch. You've been off somewhere, having lunch with friends or fighting with somebody or worrying about your life. And at that moment when you wake up from that, you have a choice. You can either take a breath and return to being here, or you can kick yourself for being out to lunch. Oh, I did it again. Oh, dummy. Right? To do that is to fall right back into that prison cell. So in Zazen, over and over and over and over, we take this practice of seeing that choice and of choosing to say, oh, here I am. So there we are in our life of problems. Buying a house, not sure we have a job, having a medical diagnosis maybe coming up we don't know about. We don't know what it's going to be, but there's something looming. And there's always this not being consumed by that, but seeing, oh, I'm also a person with other people. Or, oh, I'm just a person who's here suffering. I don't have to add to it being angry about the fact that I'm in this position. You can always start in any place, any prison cell we find ourselves stuck in, with some kindness and some gentleness. And at that point, we find that instead of hurling ourselves against the wall, there might just be a doorknob. Or at least there's a quiet moment, and we will find another way to meet the next moment. And the situation will have changed in some way because it will be another moment. This is the great wisdom of Prajna coming down into the ordinary details of our ordinary lives, because that's where we live. Personal little self is part, not thrown away, not wrong, part of a very large enterprise called being alive. And I may know by next week if I've bought a house or not, in which case I'll know what the next problem is. So I decided not to feel wasted by it at all. But it is a very interesting. But at the moment when you're in it, you know, at the moment when you're trying to get the permit or a new problem crops up, it fills our world, fills our view. And we begin with our life of practice to know that, to even to recognize that. Oh, of course it fills my view right now. And so it looks complete. And I can wait. I can hunker down. I can have something called patience. That it's just being patient with feeling impeded, and things will shift because I will find my there will be a thing called the different view, even though I don't really believe in it right now, because right now I can see a full universe of problem. The next moment it will be different. And so Zazen, for instance, becomes this very practical experience of meeting changing and problematic life. So it's all this practice of wisdom. Together. That's one of the things that Sangha is for. That's one of the reasons why getting up and chanting the Triple Refuge is always so helpful. I need a Sangha, and I need teachings, and I need a practice of awakening, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, to help me not stay trapped in the view of the current obstacle, of life as obstacle, to see it wider again, over and over and over. We never outgrow the need for these three treasures. That's the meaning of refuge. For me now, provisionally today.